Life goes on day after day.
Hello, this is Randy Thompson from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Welcome to Rock Review. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. For the next half hour, I shall be reading articles about rock and roll music from such sources as the News and Observer, The Week magazine, Rolling Stone, and Entertainment Weekly.
People, they rush everywhere.
This opening, Ferry Crossed the Mersey by Jerry and the Pacemakers. We'll be hearing more about British invasion rock later on in today's program with the 4th of July coming up. This was recommended to us by Paula Doyle. And thank you, Paula. We'll be hearing more about British invasion rock later on in today's program, and it will close it out as well.
People around every corner, they seem to smile and say, we don't care.
But first, these trivia questions. Our trivia questions come to us today once again from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader, Plunges into Music, 2007. Question number one, a multiple choice question. Which of the following was an actual recording? Was it A, Music to Make Automobiles By, B, Granny's Miniskirt, C, Sound Effect of Godzilla 1, D, Bobby Bro and the Pot-Bellied Pig, or E, all of the above are actual recordings? And question number two, a true or false. In 1969, North Carolina's James Taylor released a song called Fire and Rain, in which he sings Sweet Dreams and Flying Machines in Pieces on the Ground. True or false, this song is about his girlfriend, Suzanne, who died in a plane crash on her way to pay him a surprise visit. Hint, here's a selection from that song.
So I'm walking the mine to an easy time, back turned towards the sun. Lord knows the cold wind blows, got to turn your head around. Sure there's hours of time on the telephone line, talking about things to come. Sweet dreams and flying machines in pieces on the ground. Oh, I've seen fire and I've seen rain.
So is that true or false? Was that song about James Taylor's girlfriend, Suzanne, who died in a plane crash on her way to pay him a surprise visit? The answers to these two important trivia questions will be given, as usual, at the end of today's program.
But I always thought I'd see somehow one more time again.
The transition section for today's program is Today in Music History, and today is July 1st and 2nd. These are from www.thisdayinmusic.com and www.musicorb.com. What were the number one hits in music history this weekend? Well, you may remember back in 1966, it was Frank Sinatra with Strangers in the Night. And back in 1967, a year later, The Association with Windy was the single at number one, whereas the LP at number one that same year, this weekend, was The Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band. And back in 1972, this weekend, it was Neil Diamond with Song Sung Blue. And back in 1975, 10cc was at number one with I'm Not in Love. If you were born on July 1, you share a B-Day with Willie Dixon. 1915, he was born on July 1. He's the poet laureate of the blues. And Bobby Day, Rockin' Robin, born in 1928 on July 1. Deborah Harry, Blondie, Heart of Glass, born on July 1, 1945. Dan Aykroyd, the Blues Brothers, born on July 1, 1952. And Adam McDougall, the Black Crowes, born on July 1, 1971. Or if you were born on July 2nd, you share a B-Day with Paul Williams, the Temptations. He was born on July 2nd, 1940. And Michelle Branch, born on July 2nd, 1983. She's the singer, songwriter, guitarist. Deaths this weekend include Wilhelm Friedmann Bach, the composer, Sinfonia 64. He died in 1784 this weekend. And Wolfman Jack, the DJ, he died this weekend back in 1995. Miscellany in music history this weekend. Well, back in 1923, you probably don't remember, the first permanent radio network, WEAF in New York and WMAF in Massachusetts, were started. And back in 1956 this weekend, Elvis performs Hound Dog and is panned by a TV critic as an unspeakable, untalented, and vulgar young entertainer. And back in 1962 this weekend, Jimi Hendrix is honorably discharged from the 101st Airborne Paratroopers after breaking his ankle during his 26th and final jump. Back in 1969 this weekend, John and Yoko are hospitalized in Scotland after an auto accident. Lennon later has the car crushed into a cube and placed on his lawn. Back in 2004 this weekend, Glenn Campbell begins a 10-night sentence with 2 years probation for a drunk driving hit-and-run collision. He's also fined $900 and ordered to serve 75 hours of community service. And finally, back in 2005, the four top singer, Ronaldo, Obi, Benson, dies from lung cancer.
Baby, I need your loving. Got to have all your loving. Baby, I need your loving. Got to have all your loving. Some say it's a sign of weakness for a man.
The Four Tops. In local rock news, we see this article published in the News and Observer on the 29th of May, 2011, entitled, Novice Players Learn to Rock On at Apex School. Apex, a familiar rhythm pulsed through the room as a group of kids banged out The Who's My Generation. The singer stuttered through the defiant lyrics as two guitarists, a bass player, and a drummer recreated the music. Things they do look awful cold, he sang. I hope I die before I get old. It sounds like a classic sing. A group of teenagers taking the first steps to a rock star dream. Then the bass player halted the music. He told the band to ignore the vocals, offbeat rhythm, and keep that inner metronome. If that doesn't sound like a youngster launching a garage band, it's because John Kozicki is not just the bass player, he's a teacher. And this is Music and Rock School. Kozicki started the school in 2009 and calls this his master's program. The students separately practice 5 songs before coming together to play as a band. Kozicki likens the process to a sports team, honing individual skills and then applying them in a game. It's unlikely that you would join a soccer team, practice every week, but never play a game. Why should music be any different, he asks. The school is in an office building on the edge of downtown Apex. Most of the instruction is one-on-one, with instructors working with students on their instruments in a practice room. But the students know they will eventually be contributing to a band, even if only for a few hours. Getting the beat. The nascent band ran through My Generation All the Way, complete with an attempt by guitarist Tyler Thigpen, 13, to get his Epiphone to feedback through the amp. Then musicians launched into Give It Away by the Red Hot Chili Peppers after listening to the real version. The article skips down. More from their lessons. Kozicki's band, I Hate Mars, had some regional success in the late 1990s, and he also filled in briefly as a guitarist with the nationally known band Sponge. Kuzicki said the movie School of Rock, in which actor Jack Black plays a substitute teacher who turns his stuffy private school class into a rock band, was part of his inspiration for the school. But mainly, he said, he just wanted his students to get more from their music lessons and let them experience the feeling of playing together as a band. After the Chili Peppers, the students began to play Drain You by Nirvana. Vocals on the earlier songs were handled by 18-year-old instructor Chris Godley, but for the demo, Tyler sang and played rhythm guitar. Article skips down. You don't have to play things exactly as they're recorded, Kuzicki said. You're not just guys playing Nirvana. You're guys interacting as a band. What they get out of it. Jacob's mother, Grace Bream, said he started playing acoustic guitar but persuaded his parents to let him try an electric. He likes it a lot better. She's okay with her son's desire to play rock. I think it holds his interest more than if he were playing simple little tunes, she said. He's more likely to pick up his guitar and play. Some of Kuzicki's students form their own bands outside of school. A former student who now lives in Chicago has released an album. Kuzicki said they are getting a lesson that will last. He looks at what he's doing as providing an outlet for kids that isn't unlike sports. It is an activity that you get involved in, and if you like it, you keep doing it, he said. What I'm trying to do is teach students how to play together and how much fun it can be. That article was written by Matt Goad of the News and Observer. This next article comes to us from Uncle John's Bathroom Reader, and it's entitled Musical Presidents, Parts 1, 2, and 3. Some U.S. presidents were amazing musicians, some just dabbled, others couldn't hit a note to save their lives. Here are a few musical anecdotes from the annals of the Oval Office. With 4th of July coming up, this seems appropriate. George Washington, 1789 to 1797. Washington was not very musical. I can neither sing, he admitted, nor raise a single note on any instrument to convince the unbelieving. Yet many in his family were talented musicians, and he hired a music master to come to Mount Vernon once a week to provide instruction. The lessons would often escalate into full-blown music parties. Some participants noted that Washington preferred a large group of musicians at these impromptu sessions. Why? To drown out his own inferior flute playing. And then there was John Adams, 1797 to 1801. Adams began a musical tradition that still endures today. On New Year's Day in 1801, he invited a local band of Marines to play music at the Executive Mansion, before it was called the White House. Adams was so impressed with their skill, he urged Congress to draft a bill declaring them the official band of the young nation. Now dubbed the United States Marine Band, it is the oldest professional musical organization in the United States and has played for every president since. Thomas Jefferson, 1801 to 1809, a man of many talents, Jefferson is known to have played the cello, clavichord, and violin. And with many other passions in Jefferson's life, art, farming, architecture, it wasn't enough that he alone enjoyed them. Jefferson believed that the young nation would benefit from them as well. Music is the favorite passion of my soul, he said, and fortune has cast my lot in a country where it is in a state of deplorable barbarism. To counter this, Jefferson wrote essays on the virtues of music, urging his countrymen to take up a musical instrument. These articles also cover such presidents as James Madison, Chester A. Arthur, Warren Harding, Calvin Coolidge, and some others, but I will skip around. Abraham Lincoln, 1861 to 65, although not much of a musician, he dabbled with a harmonica and jew's harp. Lincoln's dark moods could often be swayed by a simple American sad little song. In place of the classical pieces that the Marine Band usually played, Lincoln requested popular folk ditties. His favorite song, ironically, was the tune that rallied the South. "I have always thought Dixie one of the best tunes I've ever heard," he said. Some of Lincoln's other favorites, "When Johnny Comes Marching Home," "John Brown's Body," "The Battle Hymn of the Republic," and "Camptown Races." How about Ulysses S. Grant, 1869 to 77? Well, Grant hated music. He likes to tell people, "I only know two songs. One is Yankee Doodle, and the other isn't." And, of course, there's Theodore Roosevelt, 1901-09. Roosevelt was not musically inclined, but his daughter, Alice, made musical history when she requested that the Marine Band learn to play some ragtime, a growing fad of early jazz that was looked down upon by the elite, according to a band member. And then skipping ahead to Franklin D. Roosevelt, 33-45, the wheelchair-bound Roosevelt was quite proficient on the piano and was so fond of music in general, he often said that singing should come before speaking. In 1938, Roosevelt took time out of his busy schedule to help design a grand piano to be built by Steinway & Sons. It was decorated with a gilded scene illustrating folk dances from around the world and had legs in the shape of gilded eagles. The piano, which Roosevelt often played, still stands in the East Room of the White House today. Harry S. Truman, from 45 to 53. Truman loved to play the piano. He once played so hard that one piano leg went through the White House floor. Skipping down through John F. Kennedy to Lyndon Johnson, 63 to 69. In his retirement years on his ranch in Texas, LBJ reportedly liked to drive his white convertible around the property, blaring the song "Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head" by B.J. Thomas. Other presidents covered in these articles but not covered here include Jimmy Carter, George H.W. Bush, and George W. Bush. Richard Nixon, however, was covered. I've always had two great and still unfulfilled ambitions, to direct a symphony orchestra and to play an organ in a cathedral. In fact, during his tumultuous White House years, music was one of the few solaces for Nixon, who was skilled at both the piano and the accordion. Nixon loved all kinds of music, especially classical and jazz. Ronald Reagan, 81-89, a novice piano player. For a while there, I almost convinced myself I could play. Reagan took the road less traveled when it came to music, literally. Once when I was a drum major leading my high school band in a parade, I was aware that the music was growing fainter and fainter behind me. Soon I knew they had gone one way and I another, and I had just marched out of my musical career. Bill Clinton, 93-2001, many credit Clinton's saxophone playing on the Arsenio Hall show as one of his pivotal moments during his 1992 presidential campaign. His performances at rallies made him more appealing to younger voters, but Clinton's love of music wasn't just for show. He actually loves playing and has for most of his life. During his two terms in office, Clinton often jammed with the Marine Band. When talking about music, he waxes philosophical. Music to me is kind of representative of everything I like most in life. It's beautiful and fun, but very rigorous. If you want to be good, you have to work like crazy. My musical life experiences were just as important to me in terms of forming my development as my political experiences or my academic life. Hail to the Chief. It's the official anthem of the President of the United States. It must, by decree, be played every time the President arrives at a formal function. But it comes from the boating song, from an old Scottish air, a Highlander ditty that was sung by boatmen while rowing on the locks. The song was first performed in the presence of a president, James Madison, in 1815 at a celebration commemorating George Washington's 83rd birthday. Washington had died in 1799. Chester A. Arthur, by the way, hated the song, and when he became president in 1881, he ordered John Philip Sousa, the Marine band leader at the time, to write a new presidential anthem. Sousa got to work and presented the president with two songs, one called Presidential Polonaise and another called Semper Fidelis. Arthur loved Presidential Polonaise, and the Marine band played it throughout his term, but the public never really took to it, and when Arthur died shortly after leaving office, the song died with him. Meanwhile, the Marine band adopted Semper Fidelis, Latin for always faithful, for their theme song. The song didn't become official until President Harry Truman, an amateur musicologist, actually made it official in 1954 by the U.S. Department of Defense. So the old Scottish boat song had earned its place as an American institution. So what do you know about today's feature genre, British invasion music? Well, according to this article by Robert Fontenot from About.com Guide, The term British Invasion is much easier to define as a cultural term than a musical one. Culturally, it refers to the wave of bands led by the Beatles that arrived on American radio from approximately 64 to 66. But musically, the definition's a bit trickier. There were actually three distinct musical styles that the Brits successfully utilized in conquering the Yank charts. First were the beat bands, the Beatles, the Dave Clark Five, Herman's Hermits, Freddie and the Dreamers, essentially the first pop rock bands playing pop songs with a big, relentless beat. Then there were the R&B bands, the Rolling Stones, who are playing in the background now, the Animals, the Troggs, who practiced a raw guitar-based variant on American blues, which would soon morph into garage and frat rock. Finally, there were the conventional pop groups and artists like Petula Clark, Peter and Gordon, Chad and Jeremy, who nevertheless brought a touch of gentle English whimsy and pastoral beauty to their lush arrangements. To be as precise as possible, the British Invasion sound had more to do with the pop and beat bands than the R&B one, since that genre, essentially aping an American style to begin with, became the bedrock foundation of rock and roll for the next 15 years, what came to be known as classic rock. Other definitions like psychedelic and prog would play a part in that transformation. In the end, the British Invasion is indelibly tied to a time and place. Despite the fact that the 80s saw a second wave of English bands on American radio, that invasion has almost nothing musically in common with the original one. All I hear is the sound. Examples then of British Invasion music, Peter and Gordon's A World Without Love, the Beatles' Please Please Me, the Hollies' On a Carousel, Jerry and the Pacemakers' Ferry Across the Mersey, the Swinging Blue Jeans' Hippie Hippie Shake, Freddie and the Dreamers' I'm Telling You Now, the Searchers' Needles and Pins, Herman's Hermits, Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter, the Dave Clark Five, Glad All Over, and the Honeycombs' Have I the Right. This next article comes to us from the book Behind the Hits by Bob Shannon and John Javna, and it's called Bits and Pieces, the Dave Clark Five, 1964 Top Ten. The thumping and pounding on the record that sounds like marching feet is just that, sort of. Actually, it's 4 feet on a springboard trying to keep time with the drums. After the session in which Bits and Pieces was recorded, a somewhat smashed vocalist, Mike Smith, and bassist Rix Huxley started playing around in the studio. They started jumping up and down on a springboard, author's note, a part of Dave Clark's workout apparatus, no doubt, since he was a physical fitness fanatic. Standing face to face on the board, they held on to each other and jumped up and down. The effect was added to the record, even though Smith admits to their having been slightly off due to their drunken state. It's easy to hear. Here, then, is another one of the Dave Clark Five's tunes.
Try to feel the way I do.
The next article is from Ending on a Lighter Note, Uncle John's Bathroom Leader Plunges into Music, 2007. First question, what's the definition of perfect pitch? The answer, an accordion thrown into a dumpster without hitting the sides. And question number two, what's the difference between a lead guitar player and a large pizza? Answer, a large pizza can feed a family of four.
Give me a chance to be near you.
So how'd you do on those trivia questions today? Answer one is E, the correct answer. That's all of the above, our actual recordings. All of these were actually recorded. Volkswagen made the first entry, Music to Make Automobiles By, to inspire its factory workers. It features the exciting sounds of an assembly line backed by an orchestra. Granny's Miniskirt is a bluegrass rap song from Irene Ryan. You may remember her as Granny on the Beverly Hillbillies. The Godzilla sound effects record was a Japanese export, and the Pot-Bellied Pig recording was put out by drummer Bobby Bro and his 450-pound boar named Rebel, whose grunts sound like humming. Answer number two was false. Despite the mournful lyrics, there was never a dead girlfriend in North Carolina's James Taylor's song Fire and Rain. The song is autobiographical, but not quite so literally. Taylor says it's about several things: his reaction to the death of an old friend who committed suicide around the time when Taylor was becoming a successful pop star, his battles with depression and drug abuse, and his stay in a mental institution. The line, "flying machines and pieces on the ground," actually refers to Taylor's drug addiction, which led to the breakup of his first band, The Flying Machine.
We've already said
Go Now by the Moody Blues, another part of that British invasion. But you know what? Not everyone loves rock music. Nothing profound there, of course. But the fact that TRRS does not currently have programs that cover other forms of music have led some of us to consider expanding the offerings within this program. But what do you, the listeners, think about making this program more about music in general and less about rock and roll specifically? Rock would still be a valuable component of the program, but other forms of music, from classical to jazz to country, and from local to international, could constitute major sections of each broadcast. Please phone us at 832-5138 and offer your input. This is, after all, your radio program. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Rock Review. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Randy Thompson, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. This program is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. If you have a suggestion for an artist, group, or genre of music to feature on this program, please leave a message for me, Randy Thompson, at 832-5138. So long until next time.